This is The Guardian.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I think this is the biggest scientific discovery in my lifetime, and it stands with the great scientific discoveries of all time.
We have found a new particle never seen before in Mother Nature.
What is the Higgs boson?
Well...
Hi, it's Madeline. We're popping up in your feed a day early today to look back at the life and career of a giant of physics, the British Nobel Prize winner Peter Higgs, whose death at the age of 94 was announced yesterday. From The Guardian, this is Science Weekly. I'm joined by Guardian science editor and fellow podcast host Ian Sample, who also happens to be the author of the book Massive, all about the hunt for the Higgs boson. So, Ian, to start with, for those who don't know, just give me a sense of how important Peter Higgs was in terms of his contribution to physics.
Well, I think physicists will tell you that what Higgs came up with, I mean, it's absolutely fundamental. And in one of the really early interviews I did with Higgs, I asked him this question about how important this really is. And he said, look, if it wasn't there, referring to this field, we wouldn't be here. And it is that fundamental. I mean, this theory, this field, if it didn't exist, electrons and quarks that build up atoms would have no mass. They would zip around at the speed of light, like photons do. So there'd be nothing there. We wouldn't be discussing it.
And I am going to get you to dig into that science a little bit more in a minute. But like you said, you actually met him a number of times. So tell me about him. What was he like?
Well, the word you'll always hear when people talk about Peter Higgs is humble. And it's so true. I mean, he was incredibly humble. I mean, not to the point of being annoying. He was just lacking in arrogance, probably the least arrogant scientist I've ever interviewed, and certainly the least sort of full of himself Nobel Prize winner I've ever interviewed. He considers himself lucky in seeing the right thing at the right time. And he didn't behave as if he had done something super smart, but he was incredibly sharp and wry. And one thing I remember walking out of one interview with him thinking was, I've got so many details to check that he came up with. He would come up with dates from 50 years previously, 40 years previously, specific dates of a month, of a year. And I would go back and I would need to check all these things to make sure they were right. And always they would be right. And you think, I can't get things like this right. You know, I'm 40, 50 years younger than him.
It's quite incredible, really. And it's interesting as well to hear you talk about how sharp he was. I mean, what was his background like? Was he always gifted in science?
He was born in Newcastle in 1929. He was homeschooled for a fair bit because he was ill. He would get like asthma and sometimes pneumonia from that. So as a young schoolboy, he was pretty ill, missed a lot of formal schooling. But then he went to Cotton Grammar School in Bristol. And one of the people he became sort of pretty intrigued with there was an old boy who was Paul Dirac. So, you know, uber famous physicist. And Peter was clearly adept at the theoretical side. I mean, he was certainly not adept at the experimental side, but theoretically and mathematically, he was superb.
And actually, I discovered a fun little tidbit today, which was Paul Dirac. He went to Higgs's school. It turns out that it was him who named the boson after an Indian physicist. So there's that really interesting link there. And that takes us on to the Higgs boson, obviously named after Peter Higgs and his fantastic discovery that had happened many, many decades before the particle was actually found. Now, it was given the nickname the God particle. You've given us a tantalising hint of why that was, you know, the fact that it's so fundamental to the universe and all of us, really. But perhaps we can dig into that a little bit more. Why did it get this moniker?
Let me go back to 1964, which is when Higgs published his sort of seminal paper. What Higgs found in a nutshell was that at the beginning of the universe, he said that all these fundamental particles are massless. They're just zipping around at the speed of light. And then a fraction of a second into the age of the universe, this all-pervading field, which we now call the Higgs field, switches on. And when that happens, a lot of particles gain mass. They gain the mass by interacting with this field. Electrons interact with it in one way and get their masses. Quarks, which build up atoms, interact with it in another way and gain their masses. And so Higgs wrote this up. He sent the paper to a European journal, the editor of which happened to be at CERN. That editor rejected this paper and said it was of no obvious value to physics. Now, Peter Higgs got the rejection letter, wasn't very impressed, but he revised it because he thought, I clearly haven't landed this. I clearly haven't made clear what is going on here. And so he put a par or so on the end of the paper. And one of the things that was key that he added in that was to say, look, if this field is there, if I'm right, basically, it will be accompanied by a signature particle, and that would be this boson, henceforth known as the Higgs boson, right? And that was the first time that the mention of that particle was made. And he, instead of sending it back to the European journal, he sent it to basically the American competitor, which published it. And that came out in 1964. Okay, so we then had this long gap while physicists searched for this particle because it was so fundamental. It was so crucial to underpinning particle physics. And so you had US physicists looking for it. You had European physicists looking for it with whatever tools they could. In the US, there was a massive project that had just started to build what was to be called the superconducting supercollider. It was massive. It was going to be in Texas. And there was a US physicist called Leon Lederman, a Nobel Prize winner, wrote a book, which was a history of particle physics. And it set up the hunt for the Higgs boson because this new superconducting supercollider was going to be the machine that would find the Higgs. And so his book came out in 1993, and he called the book The God Particle. There was a subheading, which was, if the universe is the answer, what is the question? Now, I went to see Leon Lederman to ask him about all of this history. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, the publisher didn't want anything to do with Higgs in the title, didn't want the word boson in the title. I totally get where the publisher's coming from on that. And Lederman was saying, you know, so we said, why don't we call it The Goddamn Particle? And the publisher was like, no, I don't think we can do that. You know, Leon was like, well, it's just so frustrating. We can't find this thing. And they eventually agreed on the God particle, which Leon justifies as being because, look, it's fundamental to the universe, but damn elusive. We can't find this thing. We don't know where it is. And that's where it got its name from.
And so the Large Hadron Collider at CERN where this original paper had been rejected picked up the search, and eventually it identifies it in 2012. Take me back to that moment, Ian, because from my memory, it was just so exciting.
No, it was incredible. And just a little bit of backstory. I mean, there was a collider in the same tunnel before the Large Hadron Collider called LEP, the Large Electron Positron Collider. And just as that was closing down, because they have a particular runtime, just as that was due to be decommissioned to make room for the LHC, some physicists there thought they started seeing signatures of the Higgs. And there was a massive push from some scientists there to say, keep running. Don't, if you dismantle it now and build the LHC, we have this years of nothing to get the new one in, you know, just keep going. And rightly, the physicist in charge there said, no, we're going to stop. We'll move on with the next collider. And they were right to do so, because when they found the Higgs particle, it wasn't what these little signatures seemed to be. They were just random fluctuations that you get in these machines. So the LHC announced the discovery of it on the 4th of July in 2012. But that day it was announced, I went over to Geneva for that, to listen to the seminar. And I'd interviewed the scientist who led the two experiments who presented their results. And so they both rock up at this seminar. And the amount of work they had put in and their teams had put in was phenomenal. Like, they were drained. Like, they were, it was a vast amount of work. I've never been more impressed by scientists ever in my career. And they gave these presentations, and the crowd, the audience, know what they've been through. And you see one team, Fabiola Giannotti, who's now the Director General, give her result. Five sigma means, is there level four discovery? Five sigma means, how confident are you statistically that this is a real discovery? Hers went. And then Joe Incandela, this US physicist who was running the other team, which is called CMS, he put up their five sigma result. And then the DG says, look, basically we've got it. And the whole place erupts. And it was, you know, it was spectacular. And the lovely thing about it was Higgs was in the crowd.
Well, I would like to add my congratulations to everybody involved in this tremendous achievement. For me, it's really an incredible thing that it's happened in my lifetime.
But Higgs was dabbing his eyes, and it was a really special moment.
As a layman, I would now say, I think we have it.
Hearing you describe that moment genuinely gives me goosebumps again. I can remember just how incredible it was. And like you say, the eruption in the hall was really, really magical. And despite the fact that it had basically taken 50 years to go from Higgs's seminal paper to that moment of the announcement of the discovery, then very quickly, Higgs gets a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, Peter Higgs, and it should be said, François Englert, a physicist in Brussels, who worked with another physicist there who had died by the time CERN announced it, another physicist called Robert Brout. Those two also, around in 1964 as well, also had a paper coming out with similar stuff to Peter Higgs. If Brout had been alive, all three of them would have been awarded the Nobel Prize. They don't give the Nobel Prize posthumously, so it went to Peter Higgs and François Englert. But this was the surest bet you can ever have on the Nobel Prizes, because the announcement was made in July, too late for that October's Nobel Prize announcement. So it was the following October. I would have, you know, probably not bet the house, but I probably would have bet the car, which is worth 50 quid, on him winning that prize. And lo and behold, he did.
I was walking along Heriot Row when a car pulled up across the road, a lady in her 60s or maybe 70 or so, and congratulated me on the news. And I said, oh, what news? And so she told me I had got this prize.
And he didn't see it as, you know, he didn't see himself as a genius. But he would use it to, you know, he obviously got a lot of invitations off the back of being a Nobel Prize winner. And he would use that to publicize physics and to encourage people to go into it.
The way that you've described Higgs, he sounds like a scientist who is just purely interested in the work and the theories and the mathematics of it all. Was there ever a doubt in his mind, do you think, that it would all come to fruition?
Not really, as far as I could tell from my conversations with him. I mean, there was one point where Stephen Hawking bet a US physicist £100 that the Higgs boson would never be found. And when the predecessor collider to the LHC, LEP, which I mentioned, didn't find it, this US physicist paid up. But obviously the LHC then did find it. And I talked to Higgs about this, and he said, you know, that the fact that Hawking had bet that it would never be found was, he said it was a bit of a cheek, and he said basically Hawking clearly didn't understand the theory. And I asked him another time, you know, what if CERN don't find it? What if they cover the ground where, you know, this should be and it's not there? And he said, well, I'll be rather sad, chiefly because of the amount of work people have put in to look for it. But he said, you know, either it or something else has to be there.
So are there any questions left today that we're still wrestling with that were raised by his work?
Well, in one sense, the Higgs boson finding it really sort of draws a line under, you know, that 50-year effort. And it's like putting a piece of jigsaw into, like, you know, 50 other pieces and putting it in the middle. That section is now complete. And in one sense, it doesn't give you anything else to go on. But what you can do, and what the future colliders and the future work in this area more broadly is going to do, is a few things. First of all, it's going to just study the heck out the Higgs itself to see if it opens any more doors to physics we don't know yet. Does it tell you something about dark matter, the whole dark universe, as they call it, this whole realm of the universe, you know, 90%, what have you, that we can't see, that's probably there. But at the same time, these new colliders, and certainly if CERN builds its future circular collider, which will be make the LHC look small, that is going to have to be, you know, a real kind of what they're terming a discovery machine, where they will be just covering a vast landscape of possibilities, a vast energy range and so on, to see what else might be there. Because at the moment, that's all they can do, because there are no theories. There isn't another Higgs theory that proposes a particle at a particular energy or whatever that you can go and look at. There aren't really many great ideas of what is there to fill in the rest of the gaps in particle physics.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for painting this picture of Peter Higgs and his life and his incredible work.
No problem, thank you.
This episode was produced by Josh and Chana, and the executive producer is Ellie Bury. We'll be back tomorrow. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.